Welcome to Movie Maniacs. Mike Rags and Chuck Curry discussing the greatest movies of all time and all the new films in theaters and streaming that you need to know about. Like us, rate us, share us. Now, here are your hosts, Mike Rags and Chuck Curry.
All right, it's another edition of Movie Maniacs. I am Mike Rags. Chuck Curry is here as well. Good to have you aboard. Another week closer to opening theaters up across the nation. Yes, cases are spiking. States are getting scared again. Who knows what's going to happen? Some movie releases have been pushed back yet again. We'll talk about that in just a bit. Joel Schumacher passed away this past week, too. One of the more underrated directors of the last few decades. I hadn't worked much recently, but obviously kind of got thrown into the mix of schlock when he started directing the Batman movies. But he does have a lot of really good movies out there that Chuck and I want to talk about. We'll talk about the passing of Joel Schumacher later on. Some other movie news as well. We'll do Fast Five. We've got lots to do on this Saturday morning. I bring in Mr. Chuck Curry. Chuck, how are you doing?
I'm doing really good. 2 points, Mike. One, how in the world are they going to open theaters? What are they going to show? And two, I actually think Joel Schumacher is a pretty interesting topic to talk about.
Yeah, a more eclectic biography than you would think, as we'll go through his movies. Way back when he was reached his pinnacle, probably back in the mid-'80s, early 90s. And we'll talk about his biography just about a little bit later on. And we've got, what is going to be in theaters? Because, well, let's go into, I did see a movie or two this past week I want to go into, but let's go into the bigger news coming out this week is that Mulan, Tenet, they move again. They move to August, which basically wipes July clean now, Chuck, unless you still count the the Russell Crowe movie, which is holding firm on July 10th. There's really no major movie releases in July now. Everything moved to August with Tenet back, August 12th being really the first one.
I mean, that news broke just within the last 48 hours of us speaking now. I thought for some reason that if there was one movie that was going to hold its release date no matter what, it would probably be Mulan, because yeah, Disney has the backup of Disney Plus and have done this already with other films. I know Mulan's a very expensive movie, well over a $200 million budget, but I thought maybe to get subscribership on the Disney Plus app, they could see how many theaters it ultimately would play on with that July 24th release, and if they for some reason didn't do well and theaters didn't open. As of this, you know, New York, Mike, the two biggest marketplaces, New York and Los Angeles, theaters are not going to be opening anytime soon.
Yeah.
You know, probably at least not for another 30 days, and that's probably wishful thinking at best. So you take out the New York and LA marketplace, you're going to impact box office substantially. So,
well, this is obviously a direct relation to the spike in cases that came over those states over the last couple of weeks now. So I think, California being one of them, I think they're just holding steady and just, you know, but I haven't seen a notice from my AMC theaters. Remember we talked about last week, yeah, they're going to open July 15th. I guess that Unhinged will play in 12 theaters.
Probably. they might have public appearances by Russell Crowe. I don't know. Signing autographs. How are they going to get people into the place? There's no way they're going to go with 12 screens. They're probably going to go with 5 or 6, maybe. So they'll probably, if let's just say Unhinged rolls, I think it will, because I don't think that has nothing to lose.
It's low risk.
It's low risk. So, okay, they put that on 3 screens, they space it out, and then they'll do a couple classics on another 2 screens and see. They'll take the temperature of the moviegoer, see who comes back and in what capacity do they come back. And I'm sure they're going to check the behavioral patterns of people. They're going to have surveys. They're going to see people when they walk in, how much concessions do these people buy. It's going to be very interesting, to say the least.
Well, you bring up the classics, and I wanted to talk about this in movie news. Did you see the number one movie last week happens to be Jurassic Park, topped the box office, and Jaws was number two.
Yeah.
Jurassic Park playing on drive-in theaters made $517,000 on 230 sites, and Jaws made $516,000 on 100.
Pretty good per screen. Pretty good per screen.
That's not too bad.
And I was looking at some of the other ones that made the top. They got Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
The original Back to the Future from 84 in a release now in E.T.
What do all those movies have in common? Spielberg. It's quite remarkable.
It is.
The imprint he's left on millions of people. Yeah. But, you know, that goes to show you the atmosphere we're living in right now is the only way you can make money outside of streaming is at drive-in theaters, which is
you know. I know I'm partial and I bring this up all the time, but I really think I wish they thought out of the box a little. Why not
go beyond back the design adventure?
Not beyond. But why not release the Poseidon Adventure and the Towering Inferno, and maybe even Earthquake and re-release and see what happens. I think there'd be an interest in that stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love Jurassic Park. I love E.T. I love Back to the Future. But let's do something a little different. I love Jaws, obviously. And I understand why they do those films. I do them too. But you're going to be looking for product to show here. Why not go back to that disaster trend and expose audience who's probably never even seen those films, but to get the chance to see those movies in a movie theater,
I don't think those movies play to this generation. I don't think they do. They don't play to this generation. Do you think this generation wants to see an exposition of Faye Dunaway and Paul Newman and what that storyline means? And they don't have the fire doesn't start for 45 minutes into the film. I mean, I just don't think. And the Poseidon Adventure, you know, is
you're
all
saddening me, Mike. You're saddening me.
Listen, you and I love those films, but I think just a generation away. It's just too many generations in between.
Let me ask you another question. How do you think Close Encounters of the Third Kind plays?
I don't think so either. No,
it's not an action film.
No. But you know, The Arrival did well, and that plays the pacing.
But I love it.
It is similar to Close Encounters. Yeah, I don't know. I just think that we're just too far away from those types of movies, Chuck. I mean, you're more apt to see the Independence Day get replayed as a disaster movie than those movies from four decades ago. This is more of a you'll see, you know, Independence Day, Volcano, Dante's Peak. That batch of disaster movies are more
right.
to play than the 70s ones. Much to my chagrin, I'm with you. I'd love to see those movies again in theaters, and I got a chance to see The Towering Inferno in your theater, which was exciting way
Pretty
back
cool,
when.
Huh?
It was. Beyond, we might never see on a big screen. I hate to tell you that. I know it's upsetting for you, but there's not too many Carl Malden movies that are going to be played on big screens anymore, Chuck. You can't
market and brand it as a 41st anniversary screening beyond the Poseidon Adventure.
How about a movie night of three movies? You play The Swarm, Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, and The Island, and you just have a big night.
I thought you were going to say when time ran out.
No, we'll go Michael Caine. If we just go all, you know,
what's funny about The Island? It's on Blu-ray. Right? I bought it a couple years ago, and one, it's a really good transfer. I always say that about Blu-rays. What's the transfer? It's a good transfer.
Yeah, it's normally
the first act and the last act of that film are fine.
Yeah.
It's the second act. It's so over the top.
Yeah.
It's just so employed. That hurts that film so much. That second act, it's pretty silly stuff. But I do like Michael Caine on that naval gun.
Yeah, that was pretty
cool. That's pretty cool.
That was the pinnacle of the movie. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've already probably spent way too much time on the island as
it's
all right.
Okay.
More movie news about Jurassic Park. Probably a character not many people remember from the first movie going to be in the next movie, and that's Dotson. Remember Dotson, who had the Barbasol can that gave it to the Wayne Knight that was going to smuggle? That character, for some reason, is coming back in Jurassic World Dominion, and it's going to be played by Campbell Scott, not the original actor. We all remember Campbell Scott from, you know, I guess some minor success in the 80s. He was in Singles. But Campbell Scott is your actor playing Dotson. Were we crying out for that character to come back?
Was he in Dying Young with Julia Roberts?
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, okay. They probably want to wrap it all around again.
Are the kids in it? Do we know if the kids are in
it? I don't know definitively, but I heard that was one of the ideas to bring the kids back also.
Okay. Well, because if you're going to bring this character back and not the other ones, how much sense does that make? You know, I mean, because this character, let's face it, I mean, he has maybe three.
No, I get it. Having said that, just the name Dotson, it has nostalgic value, no?
It does. Wayne Knight, the more you watch that movie, Wayne Knight is actually quite comical. And my daughter gets a kick out of that character. And the way he dies, too, is really good. When he sees one dinosaur, when I come back down here, I'm going to run you over. Really funny stuff. So the Dominion continues to get casting. Chuck, what other movie news are out there? There's a movie I got a chance to see I wanted to talk about. What other movie news you got?
I really don't have other than we'll do some this day or this week in movie history. This week in movie history, 1973, Live and Let Die, the eighth installment in the James Bond franchise, the first starring Roger Moore, was released. This is my first forte seeing a 007 movie in theaters. I remember I was very young. My parents, two brothers, we went to see this at the King's Plaza in Brooklyn. I always remember Jane Seymour as the Bond girl, Solitaire. Mm-hmm. Yappa Kodo as the villain, Mr. Big. But, when you're introduced as a character for the first time on a big screen, like Roger Moore for me is James Bond, he was my James Bond, Mike.
Yeah, I was introduced to him with the next movie, Spy Who Loved Me, but then went back to actually two movies because The Man with the Golden Gun was in between. He's great. We've talked about this a number of times. The first four or five films are really good. The last few just kind of – he's just too old for the part. His stunt double does most of the work.
I'll give you that.
But his tongue-in-cheekiness was really what set him apart from Sean Connery.
I agree.
And
really he looked good as Bond, too.
He did. He's an appealing actor beyond those movies, too. He's just – Pierce is always will be my favorite, and I just watched GoldenEye again a few weeks ago, but I grew up, you're right, when you think James Bond growing up, it's Roger Moore. And to me, it's really interesting. I know a lot of people love Sean Connery, and he's great, don't get me wrong, but those early Bond movies just seem dated to me. They just seem like they're from a different era of Bond. It's not the ones we grew up on with the gadgets and the cars and the women. It's all in there, but it just... The pacing's a lot different in those early Bond movies. It wasn't until like Goldfinger and Diamonds Are Forever that it really started feeling like James
but
Bond.
But what's interesting? This week also in movie history, which was June 25th, 1989, a game changer. Tim Burton's Batman was released in theaters. You don't look, and I'll expand on that in a second, but you don't look at Batman the same way, I don't think, as Bond. I don't say to myself, I grew up with Michael Keaton as Batman, so he's my Batman. I look at it differently for whatever reason than the character of 007.
Probably because you were older when you saw
it. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. But, here's what's interesting. I remember summer of 1989. I was in New York, grew up in New York. I was working in Manhattan at the time. The hype on this movie was unprecedented. I remember Barbara Walters doing a full, half-hour segment on 2020, which you could watch on YouTube, on Bob Kane, the creation of Batman. The Batman logo was in subways, and it was on buses. And I also remember Warner Brothers doing something that no other studio had ever done before. A month before the film was released, they did they aired like a minute and a half coming attraction trailer on almost every channel at the same time, saturated the market. It's the first footage people got to see, and you see Jack Nicholson as the Joker. The next day, that trailer, Mike, was released in the theaters, and I remember stories of people paying for a movie ticket just to see that trailer, watching the trailer, and then leaving the theater. That's how hyped and that's how anticipated that movie was. And here's the caveat here. Batman opens to a $50 million opening weekend, the highest grossing movie weekend at the time. And what it did is it set a precedent for opening weekend, because if you didn't open, you closed. And ever since Batman, it was all about the opening weekend. Big marketing campaigns for big tentpole, potential tentpole popcorn films, a lot of push behind it. And those studios needed that movie to open, because if it didn't open, for whatever reason, theaters didn't hold the movie. Moviegoers went on to the next thing. And it really was a game changer in so many ways. But summer of 1989, which started on June 25th, 1989, was the summer of Tim Burton's
Batman. So I couldn't download the trailer on my phone and watch
it. You could not.
I couldn't do that?
No.
Wow, what the
hell? We were a little
behind the times.
Yeah, well, we needed another probably four years to get into the infancy of the internet at home.
Was there a box office total for that, for people?
There was. And it had the biggest the biggest opening weekend, also the largest gross in the first 10 days in movie history. But the funny thing about Batman, Tim Burton's Batman in 1989, it was polarizing.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
It was polarized. Half the people that walked into theater loved it. Half the people walked into theater were, I think they were perplexed. Yes. I think here's the thing in retrospect, because there's a lot I love about this film. And the museum scene is one of my all-time favorite movie scenes of all time. Batman saving Vicki Vale, Joker dancing through the museum, introduction of the Batmobile halfway through the movie. I think that's awesome and really cool. But what's interesting, when you watch Batman now, you could see some of the errors Burton made in some of the high points that he did. One, there's too much Joker.
Yes.
All right.
Not enough action.
Okay. He goes from certain scenes where Joker in different settings without Batman. And that was a mistake. You could take that movie, introduce another Batman action scene in between the three Joker scenes in the middle.
Yes.
And you have a stronger film. Having said that, there's so much good in that movie for me.
Yeah, and I love Michael Robert Keaton. Too much Robert Wool.
There's issues.
And he does the same thing in the second one with too much of the ancillary characters like Christopher Walken. And just he gets fixated on all these characters that aren't necessary. He does it in all of his movies. That's why Helena Bonham Carter is in every single one of his movies, because she plays this one character that doesn't even need to be in it. Anyway, we're getting way off tangent here.
I'm just saying, but I think that's a pretty – listen, Batman, June 25th, 1989 – is an important note in the history, a modern history of movies and movie going experience. And it really did change the way movies are marketed forever. No doubt about that.
I've got a couple other movie news, but what other this date in movie history do you have?
Other than that, there was not in theaters. It wasn't released till a week later, but Independence Day this week, also June 25th, 1996, had its world premiere in Los Angeles as a highly hyped movie. I thought it was an event film, one of the best event films that I ever attended. I thought it was a blast. We talked about this a few weeks ago on the show. Made a big movie star out of Will Smith. I thought Randy Quaid ultimately stole that film, but I love me some Independence Day.
Yeah, and it's coming up this weekend here, so another chance to watch it if you want. I tend to watch Jaws and Roller Coaster 4th of July weekend, not Independence Day, but I feel free to do what you must. All right, couple other movie news things. It looks like the Pirates of the Caribbean series will continue, and kind of a coup in casting. They got Margot Robbie to star in the next one, Chuck. It's actually going to be written by the same writer of Birds of Prey, so there's a relationship there to pull her in.
Now, let me ask you a question. Okay. I get why they're doing this. She's an excellent choice.
Sure.
It's always dicey when you spin it to a female, the female lead thing. We know how that went with Ghostbusters, which I loved. I know. Yeah. I just want to bring that up again. I mean, it's always a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm assuming the studio said, listen, let's get Margot Robbie. They call her agent and they say, here's a blank check. And they get her on the phone. And how could she say no?
Of course. I mean, why not? Especially in the, you know, we're living in an age now where you don't know when your next job's coming and you get a big paycheck like that. Who cares what the title says or where it's set and all that stuff? And who cares if Johnny Depp's in it? It's going to make,
Listen, the people who are advocating, without Jack Sparrow, there is no Pirates of the Caribbean. Have they seen the whole franchise? Listen, the first one was a lot of fun and he was awesome in that movie. Yeah. It's a fun character. He's having a blast as Johnny Depp at his most, quirky, but whatever you want to call what he does, quirky best. But then you do, then as it goes on, I mean, those movies are bloated and, it's like, yeah. Okay, he did his thing. He did his thing. Like, do you need to see him in another one?
It's repetitive after a while. They keep doing the same thing. And,
it is.
You know, and they're long. Cool they're if, all too long.
Listen, it would be cool if they brought him back. I know they probably won't for many different reasons. But, I mean, if he came back and did a cameo with the, that'd be pretty cool. But
A couple of reboots getting word. Looks like they're closer to a director for a Twister reboot, Chuck.
I saw that.
Joseph Kaczynski will be maybe taking the helms of a Twister reboot. I mean, is it really a reboot or just another movie with tornadoes?
It's not a reboot.
It's not.
I mean nobody's going to go to that film thinking about Bill Paxton and Helen Hunt. I'm a big fan of Twister. I know the story's a little thin, but that hook of the estranged couple coming back together, he's so appealing. She's so appealing in that film. The score is great. The action scenes are fantastic. That scene at the drive-in when the Shining is playing, and that's some visually some awesome stuff.
My daughter and I watched it. It was the first time for her to see it, and the divorce stuff is a little confusing to her.
Okay.
And it's confusing to a lot of people. Why is it in this film? But anyway, like Jamie Gertz, that whole character really is not unnecessary.
So let me ask you, you're telling me that Jamie Gertz's character is not a well thought out, well written, hard hitting character?
No.
I got to tell you, when I do the one thing about that film, when I do watch it, the way she's written or play, it's pretty pathetic, actually. No.
Yeah, and the post production dubbing is really bad early on too. You can tell a lot of the voice work is done post production.
But I do like that film.
I do too. There's a scene early on when Bill Paxton and Philip Seymour Hoffman, when they see each other again for the first time, they actually hug. And I'm like, it really put me in a sour mood. I'm like, these two guys are so good and they're both not here anymore. And they're great in this movie too.
I thought it put you in a bad mood because when they hugged, you thought they were going to get Corona.
No, no.
When you watch movies now, I know we're veering again, but this is the fun of the show. When people hug or kiss or I can't help it. It's so ingrained in my mind now. It's like, move away. You're going to get Corona.
Yeah. It's weirder now watching.
Crazy.
It's weirder watching like old sporting events.
It is.
And then it's like all these people in one place.
Very much so.
We may never get back to that. But anyway, my daughter loved Twister and all that stuff. So another reboot I heard. And I don't know why they're doing it. Remember that 80s movie, Daryl? They're actually going to make a sequel out of it and potential TV series. It was a robot kid, Chuck.
Who's doing it?
It is TNT TBS. It looks like it would pop up. I only bring it up because it'll bring back some memories of a cheesy kind of E.T. kind of ripoff. Yeah,
I remember that. But they're going pretty deep in the well there, no?
I mean, really, that's the first thing I thought of when I saw it. Daryl getting a reboot. Is there a fan base out there for it? I don't know if anybody even knows it exists. And last thing I have, it looks like they will pay homage to Harold Ramis in the Afterlife Ghostbusters movie, Chuck. They say it's going to be prominent what they do for him. Obviously, he's no longer with us. The only Ghostbuster not alive. So they just recently did a Josh Gad reunion with the cast, which was a lot of fun.
Cool.
But watching it, there is a void, and he's underrated in these movies. And a lot of things he did, Harold Ramis, was underrated, even as an actor, you know?
Listen, he's a huge part of why that movie has a legacy, Ghostbusters. I mean, they're all good in that film. But he's a very talented guy, talented director, writer. He did it all.
All right. In theaters, streaming this week. We finally get the release of My Spy, the David Bautista kid movie.
Okay.
Irresistible, the Jon Stewart political comedy with Steven Carell, which you'll have to pay for. By the way, My Spy is free if you have Amazon Prime.
Okay.
And a movie I'm sure Chuck has spent about 10 yards away from and keeping it at arm's length, Eurovision, which stars Will Ferrell, about the song contest.
And Rachel McAdams, right?
Rachel McAdams, that comes out on Netflix. So that one is free if you have Netflix. So are three pretty, I mean, you've got star power in each of those three movies, Chuck. I mean, it's not nothing to sneeze at. Those are pretty, especially Irresistible. It's funny how, I wonder how they decide which movies are going to be $19.99 and which one's going to be free to the streaming services. You know, that's, how do they, you know, what price point does it have to be for us to try to make,
you know, I did an impromptu survey with three or four people this week about the price point, and they all say $19.99 is too high. Some have done it though.
So for You Should Have Left, right? They all paid $20.
Not for that one.
The latest Kevin Bacon horror movie.
But they all stay. The ones who did it had, they had some guilt, and some won't do it at $19.99. This is too high.
Yeah, 1999.
Now, but again, will people do it for Wonder Woman 84 or Bond if they went that route? Right. Yeah, they would. But there'd still be some resistance because the price is a price.
One movie that I'm glad was in 1999, although I did watch, it was free on Amazon Prime, was that airplane thriller that I was telling you about a couple weeks ago.
You did watch it.
Jason Gordon-Levitt.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Jennifer Jason Leigh, whatever his name is.
Pretty
standard stuff here, Chuck. It does take an interesting look at hijacking of a plane.
He
is the star. He's in the cockpit the whole time, and so are we while you're watching it. That is an interesting drama how it plays out. I think the movie gets grounded a little bit once they land and there's further drama on the plane.
Who released that film?
It's Prime, Amazon Prime Video, so it's
okay.
It's Prime Video.
Interesting.
It's an hour and a half. It's not going to change the world, but he does give a really good performance in it, and there is some genuine, interesting, different takes on what an airplane thriller would be. So I give him credit for that. I just think the plot is extremely thin, and the drama leaves the plane, and the movie still goes for another 20-25 minutes. So, but you know, it's if you have Amazon Prime. You got nothing to do. You pop it in. You long for the days of another, JGL movie. Well, here's one for you. Pretend he's Robin. Maybe you'll get through it a little quicker.
I'd love to see that. I would love to see a continuation of The Dark Knight Rises, to be honest.
Yeah, the best ending to any.
Listen, nobody ends a movie better than Chris Nolan. I mean, you could, like, when that's on, I could DVR just the end and watch it like five straight times. Just last 5 minutes. That's how good he ends movies, Chris Nolan.
The head nod that awesome. Alfred gives to Bruce Wayne is just great, great stuff.
And the score is beautiful too.
And I did get a chance to see Ford versus Ferrari. Speaking of Batman, he's in that. And it's actually really good. I wish I would have saw it in the theaters.
In what form did you watch it?
I watched it on HBO and watched it on TV. I mean, for free, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. Two great performances by the leads. An adult storytelling from James Mangold, who's really a good director and writer.
He is.
So, you know, it's like one of those things where it was nominated. It did get lots of praise and a lot of movies. It restores hope in films for adults, Chuck, that don't have things blowing
that's
up.
That's really – and seconds. It made money, which is good. It made more than $100 million at the box office, which is really – good to see. And James Mangold, if we get an indie Indiana Jones five,
this would be five.
He would be the director, and possibly one of the screenwriters.
But you know, Indy's high risk for COVID in this next one, so I don't know how much he's gonna have to wear a mask in this one, Chuck. You know,
if you were a betting man, we gonna see Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones 5?
Yes, but I don't think he'll be the juxtaposition of all the action. How about that?
All right, fair enough.
Does that make sense? So he'll be in it, but he won't be, you know, running away from giant balls of rock. How about that?
We'll see.
All right, Chuck, before we get into the movie career of Joel Schumacher, who passed away this past week, let's do Fast Five. Oh, by the way, I'll ask as a formality, and I know you'll say no. You watched probably 4 minutes of Leap of Faith, but did you watch anything this past week of note that you wanted to talk about?
I did not. And me and Mike have a running joke because to motivate myself in the morning, I've been watching the last 4 minutes of the Steve Martin 1990s film Leap of Faith. And I know it's very uplifting, and it's I'm hooked. I have an impulsive personality, so
yeah, that's impulsive. That's for sure. You know, what's funny is the makers of that movie keep getting the streaming results, and they're like, "Who's this one maniac that keeps watching these last 4 minutes and nothing else?"
You know, it's funny if you watch the trailer on YouTube, the original trailer to Leap of Faith, it's pretty awful.
Yeah, it's geared pretty towards awful. Steve Martin wacky comedy, right?
But if you watch individual scenes of that movie, some of it's pretty damn good.
Yeah, I would just take
individual scenes.
Yeah, I would just take most of the Deborah Winger stuff out, and maybe even Liam Neeson, who's miscast in this movie very badly. Anyway, again, we digress. Let's talk Fast Five, Chuck. Some interesting names here to get to. We'll start with Gary Busey, who started it all with Buddy Holly way back when, Oscar nominated. Gary Busey kind of went off the deep end a little bit later in his career. I will oftentimes found him very appealing on screen. He's 76 years old. Even in movies like Rookie of the Year and Schlock like that, I like him in.
I do too.
He's a great villain in Lethal Weapon. Good buddy sidekick cop in Point Break. If I say Gary Busey, you say?
I got to say three things popped up. Point Break is one. And then his turn is villain in Under Siege 2. One like
one,
sort
under
of the,
siege one, one
under, under siege, siege one. One. Yeah, you're right. And then I always found him crazy fun in Predator 2. I remember his line reading when he says, "The lions, the tigers, the bears." Oh my! Oh my. I mean, that only Gary Busey could read a line like that.
Yeah, and let's face it, he's done a lot of really good work. Even like I said, he's a great villain in the original Lethal Weapon. People forget that, you know, that fight scene at the end on the front lawn of Murtaugh's house, that's really done well.
It's really done well.
And I loved him in The Firm. He was one of the best things in that movie. He's not in it a lot. He could have got an Oscar nomination for that.
He's good.
He's really good in that film.
He is wacky, though.
He's out there. Don't, you know, he's just out, watch.
But that's what, listen, he may not be a leading man.
No.
But he's one heck of an interesting supporting actor.
But interesting, though, he was early in his career.
He could do it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
He could do it.
But the Buddy Holly story put him on the map.
Sure.
I mean, there's no doubt.
I do remember seeing him for the first time in Gumball Rally, the precursor to Cannonball Run. He's one of the crazy drivers in Gumball Rally, which was one of my early, as a kid, early favorites. Another guy who's gone off the deep end recently, who just cannot release a theatrical movie anymore. He went the way of Nicolas Cage, 54 years old, is John Cusack, who, let's face it, if you needed a 20-year-old leading man in a romantic comedy, he was the guy you go to. To me, it's easy. It's Say Anything.
Yeah, me too.
But he's done a lot of great work, and I love the casting of him as Vince Larkin in Con Air opposite of Nick Cage. And it's ironic that both of those two, maybe that was when they jumped the shark, because after that, neither one of them really did much of, you know,
well,
huge
success. Well, his last big paycheck movie was Roland Emmerich's 2012.
Right.
He got money for that one. And that was basically, after that, it's sort of like, oh, here's another John Cusack movie on the Walmart bin.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you, the worst thing he's ever done, as bad as it is, that movie, The Cell.
Oof, man.
You see that one?
Yeah, I shut it off. That's how bad it is.
Based on that short Stephen King story, him and Sam Jackson. I mean, that movie, after the first fairly intriguing first 5 minutes, which is still schlocky because they had no budget, that basically the movie is just talk. And the premise is interesting. But boy, that movie's horrible, Mike.
Yeah, his last movies are Dragon Blade, She-Rock, Cell, Arsenal, Blood Money, Singularity, Distorted, River Runs Red, Never Grow
Old. It really is interesting, the trajectory, how this all plays out, how you could be Bruce Willis, Nicolas Cage, John Cusack, and end up with that roadmap.
Yeah,
it's very interesting. I say that in the best of ways. It is really, really interesting.
And do they ever come back from it?
I don't think you do.
Yeah.
And not when you do that. Not, you know, because in 30 years, there will be people who look at the careers of certain people, like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, and say, like, can you imagine, can you see DiCaprio going in that route of ever? No. I don't.
Or Brad Pitt. Or, yeah. Or,
no, I don't. I don't think so. But why would Cusack and why would, I know Cage, we talked about this, he had IRS problems, he owed money, he had to make quick money. Then he just got hooked and, like, I guess, you know, hey, I could work a weekend, they give me $300,000 and
yeah,
I'll just churn out 20 of them.
Yeah, I'll put a different accent in this movie, and
but your legacy.
Yeah,
your legacy for generations to come. You've heard it badly,
and Bruce too. I mean, let's face it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's face it. If he didn't have the upcoming potential, maybe John McClane return. Is there anything?
But I don't think that's going to happen. But when Death Wish, when the remake of Death Wish is the biggest thing you're probably going to do in the next 10 years, that's, you know, problematic. No.
Yeah. Yeah, and the only reason that movie was put anywhere else is because Eli Roth's name was attached to it. Other than that, that would have been just another one of those.
It would have went to streaming.
Yep.
Would have been Walmart.
Yep. All right, Chuck, another one we've got here, a great actress, won the Oscar. I mean, it's kind of silly bringing it up as Annie Wilkes, but we'll talk about Kathy Bates here, who is, 72 years old.
Wow.
I mean, Annie Wilkes started it all. Let's face it, she's great. There's really no other movie, but there are other movies. She's done a lot of great stuff. Is there another Kathy Bates role that stands out for you?
Yeah, I mean, her presence as Molly Brown in Titanic is pretty cool.
Yep.
She's powerful in every scene. She owns the screen, let's put it that way. When she's on screen, she owns the screen. And obviously, the, you know, about Schmidt.
The nude scene.
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. How about her turn as the Waterboy's mom?
Pretty damn awesome.
She's
a major talent.
That's the great thing about her, though. She'll pop up in these little movies too, like that, and add a little touch of class to a movie the Waterboy really doesn't need, but she's in it.
Heck yeah.
Say, this movie's legitimate, come see it, I'm in it. I wouldn't be in it if it wasn't. And
I mean,
Waterboy made a ton of money.
Yeah, do you in 2020 you see a movie like The Waterboy making $150 million at the US box office?
No.
It did.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
Big hit, man.
It was a huge hit. It was a huge hit. All right, Chuck.
That's a time when people, they put their hands over their ears for Critic.
Especially,
they didn't care. They did not care.
Especially when it came to Adam Sandler.
Complete disconnect.
Yeah.
And it should be. When you're dealing with Adam Sandler, it should be a disconnect.
By the way, the polarization for Uncut Gems is just beyond me. I know so many people that hated that movie. And I still love that movie. And
I
you still haven't seen it. Yeah. Well, you know, you're watching Leap of Faith. You don't have time, you know?
I don't.
All right, Chuck, one of our favorite directors and comedy directors and one of the best of all time, Mel Brooks, still out there, still working, kind of. Mel Brooks is 94 years old and still punching. And obviously, the credits like Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, The Producers. Is there one? The High Anxiety, History of the World. Is there one that you put above the others?
I mean, you got to put Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein neck and neck.
Yeah, you kind of.
But you know
do.
What's interesting? I remember going to a theater to see Life Stinks. I watched it. I went on a Friday afternoon by myself when it opened.
That was a curveball from him.
Complete curveball. Yeah. But, you know, in retrospect, he gives a really nice performance. He's the star of that film.
Yeah.
And Leslie Ann Warren is a female lead. She's actually really appealing, and their chemistry is pretty good. And it's sort of a message movie in a lot of ways about the downtrodden and homeless. And it's not really that funny.
No, it's not.
But it keeps your attention. I thought it was an interesting movie. And not that it ranks anywhere near his best. I'm not trying to say that. But it was one of the last, in terms of what he did and what he starred, him himself starred in. It was actually an interesting vehicle.
And another movie he got a lot of praise for that he didn't direct was To Be or Not To Be, where he co-starred with his wife, Anne Bancroft, and came out.
You know, he's also, his production company produced The Fly and the sequel.
And The Elephant Man. And The Elephant Man.
And The Elephant Man. That's pretty cool, actually.
All right, last but not least is Tobey Maguire, who is only 45 years old.
I know. It's really his career, Mike, over the last decade.
He hasn't done.
Is he that wealthy?
He hasn't done anything. He did the voice work over for The Boss Baby. He's the narrator of that film, but he hasn't starred in a movie since Pawn Sacrifice. He played Bobby Fischer.
And now it's a good movie. We booked that. I remember we booked that at our theater. I watched it a couple times.
He's always good, too. And, you know, he is Peter Parker, but I loved him in Wonder Boys. The Cider House Rules I thought was a fantastic movie. He's great in Joyride. People forget.
Seabiscuit.
Seabiscuit. Pleasantville.
Yeah. I like
the Ice Storm. The Ice Storm is a great movie.
Tom Holland might be born to play Spider-Man, but give me Spider-Man 1 and 2 with Tobey Maguire any day of the week. They're the best. They're the two best Spider-Mans. Still the two best Spider-Mans, I think.
Something about Great Gatsby. I guess that was the last one that was of note that he did with Leo, right? He was played opposite Leo.
Yeah.
But that was 7 years ago already.
I know. Chuck. Hard to believe.
It's hard to believe. Where does
time flies when you're having fun, right, Mike?
I'd love to see him. I mean, I just don't know what he's, you know, he does have something in pre-production called Babylon that he's in, but that's on his IMDb that co-stars Brad Pitt and Emma Stone. But I don't know. I just don't know. Somebody's got like Nick Cage can't stop working and Tobey Maguire can't find a script that makes it want to work. It's weird.
Why does he just doesn't want to work.
Yeah. It's odd. Chuck, Joel Schumacher passed away at the age of 80 this last week. And obviously when you hear the passing of Joel Schumacher and most of the, you know, stories you read, a lot of them bring up the last two Batman movies that, you know, high in schlock.
Which tells you something about human nature.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. But if you look at his career, and we will here, he's done a lot of really interesting movies, eclectic in topics and style.
I agree.
And so it was well worth doing a whole segment on our show. And I'll even go back to his first film that he actually did as a director. And I saw it I think it was probably HBO, not in theaters, but I enjoyed it as a kid. And that was The Incredible Shrinking Woman, which was Lily Tomlin. He was the director of that film. First film. Charles Grodin played her husband, and she actually gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Some good visuals in this film as well, Chuck, as a woman who progresses and keeps getting to the minuscule size, and a good star vehicle for Lily Tomlin. But do you remember The Incredible Shrinking Woman? I just remember watching HBO a ton.
I remember that on, I believe, WHT also, one of the first cable antenna channels, paper, when I was really young. I remember watching that movie numerous times.
Now, not a huge hit, obviously. And then his next movie was I saw it. I saw it because Mr. T was in it, a wacky comedy with, I believe, Gary Busey might be in this film,
DC
too.
DC Cab, right?
DC Cab, I mean, which is really plays like a Stripes for the taxi cab drivers kind of movie.
Well, remember the movie Car Wash?
Yeah, Car Wash, right.
It was right around the same time, I think.
It's funny. I remember liking it as a kid. Adam Baldwin's in it as well.
Good poster.
Mr. T holding up the car door, yeah. But really, it gets forgotten because it plays more as a Mr. T vehicle, where he's really not the star in it at all.
But in those days, that's when you walked into a video store when they were VHS and you saw the box. And it's pretty cool. And it's got a lot of rentals, though.
There's nothing about it that makes you think, oh, yeah, that's a Joel Schumacher movie.
No.
It just doesn't make any sense.
You know what's interesting? And I you know, be really cool if they did a documentary. You take, like, 30 successful directors and you interview them on how they got their first break. Like, what was it about them that a studio or a production company said, we're going to give you the reins of this script, produce this movie. That's, you know, what about them or anybody that somebody says, you know, here's money, make this movie.
That's what happened next, because Columbia Pictures gives them the cash to do St. Elmo's Fire, which I know he basically would team up maybe three times with the Rat Pack, because he'll do The Lost Boys and Flatliners as well. But St. Elmo's Fire in 1985 was really his first foray into big budget. Let's get star power and let's try to make money in movies.
And you're working with ego there.
A lot of ego. I mean,
I like that movie a lot, actually.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot. And then he would go on to, you know, I don't know what they expected out of The Lost Boys, Warner Brothers, but the movie made a ton of money. Had star appeal as far as the Brat Pack with Kiefer Sutherland and Jason Patrick very early in his career. Don't forget, Haim and Feldman are in this as well. The Lost Boys, you know, is it a great horror movie? No, but there's something about it that has a Goonies feel to it.
Now, let me tell you something. back in the day when this movie came out, what year Lost Boys? What
87.
Year? 87. Okay. 1987. They used to do, again, we're talking pre-internet, trying to create buzz. They used to do 1 week before it was released in a broader scope nationwide, they would do a one-night screening to try to create buzz and word of mouth,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they had that one-night screening. I went to the Kingsway. I think it was a Saturday night to see the Lost Boys, one with my brother, and the audience, it was packed. And Mike, the crowd had an amazing time when he says it's the return of Eddie Munster. That scene, holy smoke, the place went bananas. I mean, it was so much fun. And I saw that movie probably 4 or 5 times in the theater. I'm a big fan of Lost Boys.
Yeah, and it's very stylistic. You can, Joel Schumacher's hands in it all over the place, and good casting, by the way, of Diane Wiest and Edward Herman too,
and that twist with Edward Herman,
that's pretty cool. Yeah,
that works big time. And Keith Sutherland, he's pretty damn menacing in that movie, Mike.
He is. He's really
that's serious vampire lore. It's not, you know, I can see that scaring little kids.
And it's another head scratcher in the career of Jason Patrick, which never got off the ground. It just he was really good in it, and it was early in his career, and it just never. He had 3 or 4 start with whether with this. Sleepers or Speed, he had 3 chances to get his career going, and just Speed 2, it just never got going. After that movie in 1989, he did a smaller film with a big cast in it, Ted Danson, Sean Young, William Peterson, a movie called Cousins. It's about swapping partners at a wedding. No, not much there of note.
They don't make movies like that anymore, though.
No, and then Flatliners would come out, Chuck, which I remember when I heard the concept for this movie, I got really excited to see about medical students killing themselves, go near-death experience, and so we can learn what's on the other side. I'm like, wow, there's a fascinating topic. Let's explore it. Where can we go? And then it turns into a schlocky mess of a slasher movie where really this is where we're going to go, where we bring back our nightmares and they start killing people. I mean, it was a wasted opportunity. It does have great visuals from Joel Schumacher, but I was highly disappointed in this movie.
Me too. And I'll tell you, because the concept's there. It's not, again, he's just filming the script. I mean, I don't know how much control he had over the script, but to go where they went in that second half, it had no interest to me.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, watching this. You got, William Baldwin, Kevin Bacon, Julia Roberts, and Oliver Platt, the other medical students.
Yeah.
This movie is Kiefer Sutherland's movie. He is the lead in this. And it's interesting that of all the star power in this film, that they geared it towards Kiefer Sutherland. Very appealing, don't get me wrong, but you got the likes of Julia Roberts.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, it's interesting about – I don't want to veer too much, but Kiefer Sutherland, I mean, the guy really became a star when he did 24.
Yeah,
he does all these movies. He's definitely competent and he's all right. Does 24? It's like, wow, this guy's a star.
Then and you brought up Dying Young earlier.
TV.
He did direct Dying Young with Julia Roberts the very next year in 1991 with Campbell Scott. I remember this movie, Chuck. You remember Premiere Magazine used to come up with their summer movie preview edition, and they would rank their predictions of what would be the biggest movies of the summer. And I remember when this edition came out for 1991, their bold prediction was that Dying Young with Julia Roberts, because of her star power, would be the number one movie of the year. And boy, it wasn't even close. I mean, it's basically a Hallmark movie with him directing and her starring.
I remember. It was definitely schmaltzy, to say the least. It made money, though, because Julia Roberts is the lead.
It did, but I don't think nearly enough as what the studios were hoping for.
How excited were you when you got an edition of Entertainment Weekly back in the day? I remember when the first one was announced to come out. I was like, wow, are you kidding me? They're going to do a magazine weekly on movie. I was so excited, and I loved Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah, but I'm talking even before that. I've got the Premiere magazine.
Premiere, too, man. That was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yep. Falling Down would be maybe the best movie he would do, Chuck, to some, and maybe even you and I, 1993. He's the director. Of course, you got Robert Duvall and Michael Douglas. We've talked about this movie a lot, but there's some great direction in this movie, too, especially the scene at the end where he's running out on the Santa Monica Pier, and some of the camera work he does in this film is really good. The score is really good at that point in time, too. We love this movie. And a lot of it has to do with his direction and the two leads.
I remember seeing this, Mike. I stayed over in New York City, and I watched this movie with a sold out crowd. I must have seen this 4 or 5 times in the theater. I love this film. The visuals are awesome. I love the character. Defense, that's his name on the license plate.
Defense.
But here's what's interesting about this movie and the script. You don't see this much anymore. They took two characters. They gave them equal screen time. They're both extremely interesting. They're not on screen together at all until the last 10 minutes of this movie. Right? Robert Duvall, Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
And they're both – it's like two different movies that merge as one in the very final stages of the last act. On a hot day in Los Angeles, it's a pretty cool movie. And yeah, I'm a big fan.
And it probably plays pretty damn well right now, considering the climate we're in. Chuck, he would then do his first John Grisham movie. I know you're a fan of this film. I didn't think it's as good as his next one, with The Time to Kill, but he did direct The Client.
It's a good movie.
With Susan Sarandon and Tommy Lee Jones. And the late the young kid in this movie passed away. What's his name? Brad Renfro. He's a young star in this. I read the book. The movie doesn't live up to the book, but it's definitely passable. And
it's a good cast, though.
Yeah, it's a great cast.
Yeah,
it's a great cast. Then he would do his first Batman movie, Batman Forever, Chuck. And you know, it's not horrible. As horrible as people think, I think they team it up with the next Batman movie.
Yes, they do. Let me expand here. Okay, in 1992, when Batman Returns is released, Warner Brothers had a marketing deal with Burger King, and movie comes out. Again, another polarizing movie. Batman Returns is pretty dark, and it makes money, but not the money Warner Brothers wanted with the franchise. So they decide to part ways with Tim Burton. Michael Keaton won't return, so they go to Val Kilmer. They very quickly search for a director, and they latched on to Joel Schumacher because they knew he could mount a competent film. I remember going to see Batman Forever at the time was the most successful Batman movie in terms of box office. Mm-hmm. It played to the mainstream accessibility that the studio wanted.
Introduce Robin, of course.
I actually found that movie pretty entertaining. Now, you got to realize in the contents of the Chris Nolan movies didn't exist yet.
Right.
So all you had to go on is the 66 TV series, the two Tim Burton Batman movies. So he does something a little different. Here's the thing. When you watch a trailer and you see the Batmobile drive up an apartment wall, you go like, ah, come on. That's, you know, I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
Having said that, there's some good stuff in it. It has entertainment value. Jim
Kilmer's
Carrey.
Underrated. Kilmer's underrated.
Yeah, he's very interesting. He's very interesting as the Bruce Wayne character in this film. Definitely different than a lot of interpretations. And Jim Carrey's fun and you know, hitting his stride after Ace Ventura.
But again, much like what he does with Batman and Robin, and we'll talk about him, might as well, back-to-back. They did it 2 years later. But too many characters. There's just too much star power.
Nicole Kidman is a lot of star power in this film, a lot of production value. Having said that, there's enough tightness in the movie that I think I still think if you understand what he's going for, it plays fine. It has a lot of entertainment value, has some good sequences in it. Now, Batman and Robin, let me just say this. First of all, on the DVD audio, he apologizes for the film. Very few people do. Here's the thing. He was told by Warner Brothers with Batman and Robin, we want to make a movie geared to young kids with the tone of the original 66 TV show. And he delivers that. It's wildly overproduced. It has way too many star power. Chris O'Donnell is as annoying
it's terrible. And Alicia Silverstone. Come on.
He's so damn annoying as Robin in that movie.
Yeah.
It's like you want to slap him. Alicia Silverstone is
bad.
Is good Batgirl. Yeah. I mean, George Clooney, he's fine as Batman. There's one or two good scenes with him and Alfred. Alfred's dying of cancer in the movie. Mr. Freeze, it's just, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger gets top billing, I think, in that film.
Yes, he does.
He has so many corny one-liners. Yeah. Uma Thurman is, you know, crazy one-liners. It's not unwatchable, though. It's just silly. It's just, it's not made for you and me. I mean, like, it's, but you can't look at that movie and say Joel Schumacher did a bad job. It's not, he defilmed what they wanted. That's
But the problem is you can't go back and watch it now either, because you know the other Chris Nolan movies is like, this is a cartoon. This is basically, you're watching Adam West.
It's worse than that. Yeah, it's actually worse. Listen, Batman and Robin on ice skates.
Yeah.
I mean, holy smoke. Like, you can't listen. If you were born, and your first entry, like we were talking about, my first entry of 007 is Roger Moore and Live and Let Die in the theater. Some young kid walks in the theater first time and watches the Chris Nolan Batman films, or even Ben Affleck as Batman and Zack Snyder's Batman v Superman, and then goes back and then puts on Batman and Robin. It's like, holy smoke.
What are we doing here? Yeah.
Like, this is really silly stuff. But it, you know.
Silly.
And it's crazy overproduced. It's crazy overproduced. Holy cow, is it over.
But the movie he does in between is fantastic, and that's A Time to Kill, the John Grisham's second film he would do about race relations and the legal drama that proceeds with Samuel Jackson, Matthew McConaughey, and Sandra Bullock. And you got to give him a lot of the credit for casting Matthew McConaughey perfectly in this film. He's basically an unknown star of Dazed and Confused. He's recognizable, I guess, but to have the cojones to say, no, we're going to go with this guy in this role, this meaty role, and it worked big time for
that's really good. And listen, it opens the door. He saw something, gave him the chance, and Matthew McConaughey killed it in a film. I just want to preface real quick, you can't talk about Batman and Robin. You got to talk about the bat nipples. You got to talk about the bat nipples. And now we'll move on. But yeah, Time to Kill is a really good movie.
And Matthew McConaughey would run with it too, because he'd become a major movie star after that. And just some great stuff in that movie. And again, people forget that this is the guy directed. That's why I wanted to bring up these films. You remember the movies, you're like, they don't stand out as, oh, this director did this. Like, it's not like John Carpenter's The Time to Kill. This is like, you often forget that one person's responsible for movies. You know, after he does the Batman and Robin movie, he probably does his grittiest and really maybe the grittiest movie he'd ever do. An 8mm would come out in 1999. What a movie, Chuck.
Let me tell you, Mike, I love me some 8mm.
Great movie.
They don't make movies like that.
No, and Cage is fantastic in it.
And talk about Doc.
Oh, my God. Joaquin Phoenix as well. James Gandolfini is.
And also, think about this. You don't get studio fare.
No.
It goes into snuff. You're talking about snuff movie
films,
material.
I know.
Come on. This is really uncharted water in really interesting stuff.
Great stuff. And
it's a really good movie. If you like really damn, I don't know, if you want to categorize it as a B movie with some money behind it, say what you want. It's really good.
Yeah, and it showed you the great star power of Cage at the time, too. After that, he'd do a couple of smaller films, Chuck. Flawless, which got some critical praise. Co-star
Joaquin Phoenix is in that movie.
Yeah, 8mm, yeah. Flawless, which stars Philip Seymour Hoffman and Robert De Niro as a cross-dresser who lives next door. Yeah. A lot of people seem to like that. Tigerland, a war movie that he did with Colin Farrell in the lead, got a lot of notice as well. And then he would come out with a movie that basically – was probably the worst of his career, and I hated this movie, and that's Bad Company, the inspired casting of Anthony Hopkins and Chris Rock in a CIA action movie. This movie is terrible, Chuck, and mainly because they cast Chris Rock as twins, one a CIA agent, and one a fast-talking swindler. I mean, this movie is bad, and Anthony Hopkins, you can see him, like in some scenes, I think they take place in a bank where he's cashing
his check. Yeah, but let's be honest, that's what you call, he's working Schumacher as a hired studio gun at that point, no?
Yeah,
I mean, they're like, we got this script, we want to throw some money at it, we need somebody who's going to bring it past the finish line, you want to do it, here's some money.
Well, he would team up with Colin Farrell and Kiefer Sutherland, basically his last most notable movie in theaters, and that's Phone Booth, which came out in 2002, the same year. It's basically that you can almost hear the pitch. It's speed in a phone booth.
That was what you call an experimental film.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
You know, I have a hard time watching a movie that takes place entirely in New York.
Yeah, I knew it, but if you know what it is going in, you got to know what it is. You have to know what to do. You have to know what they're doing and going. If you just say, if the movie just starts playing, you have no, then you're going to be like, okay, does it ever get out of the box, right?
The same thing happens.
If you know it stays in the box before you watch it, it plays better.
Well, when you hear the concept of speed, you're like, come on, the whole movie on a bus. So really, and then they expand it. It's not just that. This movie never does that.
No, because they didn't use the money to do it.
No, and Colin Farrell's okay in the role, but he's not a very likable character, to say the least. And, you know, what bothered me was this movie takes entire place in New York City in a phone booth, and I don't know if they shot a single shot in New York City.
I actually think most of it's shot in Toronto. I'm trying to my mind's eye trying to recollect here, go back in time. I think that was a vehicle for Jim Carrey, and then as they got closer to production, he bowed out, and they wound up casting Colin Farrell in the lead.
Well, he teamed up with Jim Carrey. We'll get to that in a second. He does Veronica Guerin, which is a really good movie with Kate Blanchett about an Irish journalist who has a horrible fate. That's really good if you haven't gotten a chance to see that. Then he does Phantom of the Opera, which was a retelling of the story, which actually starred Emmy Rossum and Gerard Butler
in
the leads. Nobody saw that. Nobody saw that. So add that to the lexicon.
I know a lot of people who like that movie, though.
Yeah. And then he does the number 23, which would be a Jim Carrey vehicle. That flops big time.
That's a bad movie, though. That's a bad movie. It's a bad movie. I watched that on Blu-ray one day, and it's hard to get through. It's not good.
No,
it's what it is, though.
But he keeps going to the number 23 in a book, right? And it's making him go crazy. After that, we would get smaller movies like Blood Creek, 12, Trespass, and he does a couple of episodes of House of Cards. But that's the career of Joel Schumacher, Chuck, and I guess overall, it's like one of those things where unless you go through and look at a guy's IMDb page, sometimes you don't understand the impact.
Oh, and he's not defined by his work on those two Batman. It's ridiculous.
And I think part of it, too, is a lot of these movies we talked about, there's no discernible style of a Joe Schumacher movie. You know, there's not like this. No. Oh, I can tell he directed it, and I think that's why it gets lost in the shuffle.
Agree.
All right, Chuck.
He knew how to mount a movie. He knew how to tell a story.
And
he was a good director.
And let's face it, too. He was one of the few people that had come out of the closet as well. He was a homosexual director in a time, you know, getting big budget movies handed to him, you know, which is an accomplishment in its day in Hollywood at the time.
Agree.
All right, Chuck.
Work.
We will do it all over again when we break down some more streaming movie releases next week.
I'll try to watch a few. I'll let you know what I think.
I think there's, if you want to come back.
I'm actually, I closed the show saying I got my sleeping bag. I'm sleeping over at my local, my independent theater that I'm waiting for us to open on July 3rd. I got a couple cases of water and boxes of cereal and a sleeping bag, and I'm ready to go.
The more we get closer to the release of Unhinged, I'm starting to think it's about your life, not Russell Crowe.
Probably.
All right, Chuck. We'll do this again next week, my friend.
Always a pleasure, Mike.
Thanks for listening to Movie Maniacs. Download one of our archived episodes. Be sure to subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. Podcasts by Federated Media. Podcasts by Federated Media.